And now for our second message, a sermon by our local elder, Mr. Scott Delameter.
Thank you, Mr. Knutson, and happy Sabbath. And thank you to whoever provided the water. The ancient people on the Greek island of Crete, they were known for fighting. They were known for fighting each other, and fighting each other often. They'd have skirmishes and they'd have battles. And the historian Plutarch describes some of this. He was writing back around the time of the early church. But he noted that when they were attacked from the outside, all of these people that fought against each other, they would come together, they'd join together, they'd fight off these enemies. They were pretty rough and tumble people. But they'd combine forces to fight. And they came to be known by some as a Cretan federation. In Greek, this was called the syncretismos. Cretans would come together and they would be a syncretismos. From that word and from that idea, we have the word today, syncretism. And over time, that word came to mean other things. And it's most commonly used now to describe attempts to join two sets of conflicting religious practices. Religious practices that are at odds with each other, really. One author describes them this way. He says, it's the mixing of elements of two religious systems to the point where at least one, if not both, of the systems loses its basic structure and identity. You take these two systems, you bring them together, you try to bend them to fit together, and now they don't look like anything they were before. They've lost their identity, they've lost their core, they've lost what they are. They're something totally different now. This is the idea of syncretism. But the history of syncretism, of course, predates Crete. It goes all the way back to the beginning of man's history. Turn over to Genesis 3, if you will. Paul tells us in a couple of places in the New Testament, he tells us that all of these things were written for our examples. Speaking specifically about ancient Israel, he says these things become our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and that all these things happened to them as examples and were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. In Romans 15, he actually broadens this idea. He says, everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the scriptures and the encouragement they provide, that we might have hope. We're going to go through some histories today. We'll go all the way through right up to the present time. We'll skip around, of course. But Paul's telling us that the things that are written here in this book, the histories that are written here in this book, are written there for our admonition, for our encouragement, so that we can endure, so that we can have hope, and that we can get through some of the tricky spots, that we can get through some of the hard times. Again, as he says, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And as the ends of the age draws closer, things become difficult. And there is more pressure to compromise things and ideas, to take the things that we believe and that we have understood and compromise them and bend them and maybe merge them with things. We know that at the very end there will be a beast power that is trying to get everybody to just conform and have this one idea. Everybody, get everybody on the same page so that we can fight against that guy in Jerusalem. That's the big idea. We know that's ultimately where it's going. But we're told that these histories encourage us and will give us the endurance that we need. Let's go back to Genesis 3. The core idea of syncretism started back here. It started here in the Garden of Eden. Genesis 3 and verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, 'You shall not eat of every tree of the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat the fruit of the tree of the garden, but the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, 'You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.'" And the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. For God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave her husband with her, and he ate. You'll notice we all hopefully have heard that story and know that story and understand it and think about it from time to time. The core ideas of syncretism are right there buried in. Satan doesn't, he doesn't try to get her to just totally abandon God. He doesn't say, "Well, you should just forget about everything that he told you." He tries to add to it. Let's append to it. Let's mix in this other thing. You know, I know what God has told you, but here's also this other thing. This will make you wise. This is good for you. God knows that when you eat this, it'll make you wise. So he adds, he appends, he brings in something else. It's this sort of, it's not this wholesale abandonment of God. It's God plus this, God and some other thing. And Satan introduces it from the beginning. And our tendency, our nature is to say, "Oh yeah, that's interesting. I really like what God is offering, but there's this thing that's interesting too. We should bring that in. That's really neat. This is a good idea over here. I heard about this other thing. We should try that. We don't have to abandon God. We can mix it in. It'll be fine." And this has been the story of human history. Let's go over to Exodus 20. Exodus 20 and verse 3. So this is where man has started from. But then God finds this faithful man. He found a few faithful people who would actually put him first and make him the only one. It wasn't just that God was first. It was that he was the only one. For Abraham, God was the only God. He didn't add to anything. He didn't try to append any other stuff. God was God, and he did everything that God said, and that's what set him apart. That's what made him distinct from the people around him. Exodus 20, and in verse 3, he says, "You shall have no other gods before me." He doesn't just say, you need to worship me. He says, "I need to be it. I need to be the only God. No other gods before me." It means you don't have any sort of sitting out here on the table. You're worshiping me over here, and then there are some over here. And he goes on to tell them that they shouldn't have idols. They shouldn't have graven images. It isn't part of worshiping God. And so he makes this very clear and puts it out there and says, "I need to be the only thing in your life, the only God in your life, the center and the focus of it. Don't add to it." But we know that didn't last very long. Let's turn over to Exodus 32. So as God was giving those Ten Commandments, the people became very fearful. Said, "You go talk to God. He's scary. You go talk to him for us." And so Moses went up on the mountain, and he was up there a long time. And the people didn't quite know what was going on. Exodus 32 and verse 1. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come and make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And so Aaron said to them, "That's ridiculous. You just heard that we're not supposed to worship any other gods." No. Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then he said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." He didn't say, "Oh, this is that Egyptian God that you remember that they always used to worship." He didn't try to introduce some new God, but he made an idol and he said, "This is your God. This is the God that's up there talking to Moses. This right here." So when Aaron saw it, in verse 5, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." He didn't say tomorrow is a feast to this new God that I'm introducing. Right? He's taking their old way of doing things, the things that they probably saw in Egypt, the ways of the people around them, and he's blending them in and saying, "We're going to worship God this way. This is how we're going to do it now. This is all okay because it's all targeted at God. This is great. This is what we're going to do." And everybody was on board. And everybody thought, "Yeah, this is fine." In verse 6, "Then they rose early on the next day, and they offered burnt offerings." Now, burnt offerings weren't something new. Abraham had offered burnt offerings, you'll remember. We're told elsewhere that Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came and offered burnt offerings. Burnt offerings were something they were familiar with. It was part of the approved practice, if you will. It was part of something that God had commanded, that God had set a precedent for. So again, this wasn't them going out and doing some sort of weird child sacrifice. This was them taking the practices that they knew and understood and using them in a way that was inappropriate, using them in a way that didn't glorify God. And they brought peace offerings. Again, peace offerings are something that was commanded. And the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. Rising up to play has implications of drunkenness and sexual overtones. And so here they're taking practices that are not prescribed by God at all, but again, that they were probably familiar with from the society around them. And they're taking that part of it and bringing it in and saying, "Yeah, this is part of how we're going to worship God here. We're going to do all of this all together. And this is good because it's all for God. We're targeting this at God. And so all of this is okay." And this is what the people did. And we know that that wasn't very well received. God said, "These are your people." He tells Moses, he says, well, we can read it. Verse 7, "Go get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves." God's ready to disown them. Say, this is completely unacceptable. You know, he had just told them, I need to be the only thing, the center of your worship, and the only being that you worship. And he was ready to disown them at that point. But Moses and God had a discussion, and God agreed to back off from that position. But we see that this was a big issue and a big problem. So Moses, at the end of his life, he's giving a speech, and he's teaching Israel, and he's telling them things, and he's reminding them things. And we can see one of the big things that he harps on over in Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Chapter 12 and 13 talk a lot about syncretism. They talk a lot about merging of practices, of doing things in different ways and bringing things from other cultures and other ideas. But notice verse 29. "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land," he's saying, "you're going to cross the Jordan and you're going to take over and conquer this area. When God does that for you, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, 'How did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise.' You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way." Notice, he's not saying you shall not worship their gods. He's saying don't worship God, the real God, in the way that these people are worshiping their gods. Don't try to take their ideas and their practices and worship the true God in the way that they do it. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it. Again, there's the kicker with syncretism. You don't add to it, you don't take away from it. You leave it right there where it is, exactly as God prescribes it. It's not God plus. You don't append things. Right? He wants us to do it just the way that he says. Not because he's some overbearing tyrant, but because he knows what's good for us. He knows the things that are going to lead to life, to peace, and to happiness. So he says, do these things. Don't add to them. Don't take away from them. We see that Israel has a pretty poor history of following that. During the time of Joshua, after Moses died and they went into the land, during the time of Joshua, they did follow God. They followed after him very diligently. And then all of those in the generation that had been alive when Joshua was leading them, it seems that they all followed God also. But then after that, it started to get a little mixed up. And they would bring in elements here and bring in some things there. So that by the time you get over to Judges 17, you see a very interesting thing going on. Turn over to Judges 17, if you will. Judges chapter 17. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim, whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me. I took it." And his mother said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." So a very odd thing going on. It seems the son stole some money from his mother, but brought it back, and she's thrilled about it. So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image." Notice, she had dedicated the silver to God to make an idol. This is how mixed up it had gotten. "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you." Thus he returned the silver to his mother, and his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. So he had a carved image and a molded image, and those things were idols there in his house that he kept. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, and he was a Levite and was staying there. And the man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" So he said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am on my way to find a place to stay." Micah said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance." So the Levite went in. You'll notice if you go back up to verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine. So it's talking about this idol that he has. He has a shrine for it. And he made an ephod and household idols. And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So the guy knew enough to say, "Well, I need to worship God. And in order to worship God, I need to have a priest and I need to have an ephod," which is a priestly garment. And so he made that and got all this going. And here he is worshiping God in a way that he believes to be correct. And then this Levite comes along and he says, "Oh, well, this is even better." It's interesting. He understood that he needed a Levite, that the Levites would be the priest. And he understood enough about what was prescribed that he knew he needed an ephod, and he knew that there were certain practices involved. He knew some of the things that were correct and some of the things that should be done. Somehow, he missed the fact that he wasn't supposed to have an idol in his house. and that he wasn't supposed to have graven images and carved images. How it got to that point, we don't quite know. But there was this mix. There was this blend. Here he is worshiping God, the true God, in a way that he sees as best. Every man doing what was right in his own eyes. He's doing what he thinks is pretty good. And he has a pretty reasonable understanding of some of the elements that were required. So Micah consecrated the Levite in verse 12. And the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as priest." He said, "I don't just have my son as priest. I've got a Levite. I'm really doing things right here." The story goes on. It doesn't get any better. But we see that there was this idea then and there in that time that these things could all sort of be mixed up. And people were very confused. People had maybe lost knowledge of God, had lost knowledge of his laws and his ways, and they were just blending the religions around them in with what they did have and what they did understand. And this is syncretism. Let's go to 1 Kings 11. We know that under David, that changed. David was faithful to God. And again, God calls him out as a man after his own heart because David was singularly loyal to God, like Abraham. And we see him commended so often. And we know he's going to be rewarded very richly because he was singularly focused on God. There was nothing else. He didn't bring in any of this other nonsense. He was just right there thinking about God, focused on God, writing about God, writing songs about God. His whole existence was focused on God. Solomon, it seems, was following along that line for a while, but it didn't end up well. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, "You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn your hearts away after their gods." But Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods. And his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. Again, it doesn't say he totally abandoned God, but his heart wasn't loyal. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. And Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. It's noted, some of the commentators note that it's not necessarily that Solomon even went out and commanded that these places be built, but God holds him responsible because his wives had this happen, coordinated this effort, had these things done. He didn't do anything to stop it. He was just sort of going along with them, letting them do that, build that thing over there. You know, we've got the temple over here. He had built a big temple, and it was a much nicer temple than those high places over there, probably. You know, so yeah, they can have their things over here and over there, and they'll have their high places, and they'll do their thing. And we've still got the temple here, and we'll still worship God. Again, it wasn't that he just walked away. He didn't go burn down the temple, right? But he allowed these other things to exist. To coexist there with him. Verse 8. He did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore, the Lord said to Solomon, "Because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant." This was the reason that God divided the kingdom. This was a big event in Israel's history. He split the kingdom. He tore ten of the tribes away from Solomon and gave them to another. And the reason for that was because of syncretism. It was because Solomon had brought in these other elements, allowed them to coexist with the worship of the true God. And they were sitting there right alongside. That was the root cause. That was the main reason that God said, you're not going to be king over Israel. Over all of Israel. That your descendants won't be. I'll keep this remnant over here for the sake of your father David, because David was loyal. You'll have these two tribes. You'll have Judah and the Levites primarily. The rest of them he took away. He stripped it from Solomon. And it was because of this. It was because of syncretism. If you look at 1 Kings 12, chapter over. So God takes away 10 tribes from Solomon, and he gives them to a man named Jeroboam. If you look in 1 Kings 11 and verse 40, Solomon knew about this. He knew that Jeroboam was going to be an important guy. So in verse 40, it says, Solomon therefore sought to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So we get a little bit of background on Jeroboam. He's now gone to Egypt, and he's lived there for a while, and he's absorbed some of their culture, and he's got their ideas and some of their thinking. Now in verse 26, we see that Jeroboam is given the kingdom of Israel. Let's go verse 25. Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So Jeroboam's worried about the security of his reign, of his monarchy. He wants to make sure he's going to be safe. He's trying to figure out how to make sure the people will stay loyal to him. Of course, God had already told him, I've given you these 10. But that wasn't quite good enough for Jeroboam. Verse 28, therefore the king asked advice, made 2 calves of gold, and said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set one up in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. So he makes 2 calves. Again, this may have been Egyptian influence, which is where he might have learned, hey, we should worship cows. And he makes 2 idols. He sets one up in Dan, which is in the northern end of Israel. And he sets one up in Bethel, which is in the southern end of Israel, on the way to Jerusalem. So as people would be traveling to Jerusalem, they'd have to pass through right where he's installed this idol for them to worship. And he says, these are your gods. This is your God. In some translations, they render it singular, because both of those idols were supposed to represent God, the true God, saying, this is your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt. And so he's setting up an alternative means for them, still to worship the real God, the true God, but do it in this way. Verse 30, now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month. Feast of Tabernacles is in the 15th day of the 7th month. And he ordains a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made. And at Bethel, he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. So he said he knew there was priestly involvement in worshiping God. Verse 33, so he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. Elsewhere we read that it wasn't even just that. It was that he allowed anybody from any class of people to be a priest. You didn't have to be a Levite anymore. Anybody could be a priest. He was sort of the original priesthood of all believers guy. And anybody could do this. And actually, the Levites left. Many of the Levites left Israel and went and lived in Judah because they recognized that what he was doing was wrong. And so he just opened it up. He opened it up and said, hey, this is fine. This is all good. We're still worshiping God. You know, this is all still directed at God. Our intent is really good here. We're just doing things a little bit differently, was all. Again, it was a big deal. And so we see that was the pattern. God assesses them over in 2 Kings chapter 17, if you want to turn over there. 2 Kings 17 and verse 16. So they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, made for themselves a molded image and two calves, made a wooden image and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. And they caused their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire, practiced witchcraft and soothsaying, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, to provoke him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. He says this is the reason that Israel went into captivity. Is because they decided to try to worship God however they wanted to, in whatever way they wanted to, whatever ways they saw fit. It was syncretism. Syncretism is what drove them and ultimately Judah into captivity as well. We see this in the New Testament. In the New Testament, we'll hit some of the highlights. We've talked some in the past about the Pharisees. The Pharisees were an interesting sort of syncretistic blend, because they were a very progressive movement. And so while they held to held very tightly to the law and hedged it, they sort of brought in traditions as being supreme or more important than God's law. And they brought in what would then have been called perhaps New Age thinking. They were trying to sort of promote things forward, move things forward. They were a very people-oriented group. They weren't just so much about the priests. It was about all of us should be doing things and that are kind of priestly, which is why they had their washings and why they had their special rituals that they did before their meals, just to sort of copy the things that were done in the temple. So again, they were sort of progressive movement, bringing in some of their own ideas and blending things. We see a few references to the Samaritans in the New Testament. Jesus gives a parable about a good Samaritan, and we see him talking to a Samaritan woman over in John 4. He goes to a well, and he's sitting there, and he's talking to this Samaritan woman. We can go back. Let's go back to 2 Kings 17. We'll see a little bit of history, because again, we'll see syncretism very strong here. Second Kings chapter 17 and verse 24. So this is after Israel has been taken into captivity by Assyria. The Assyrians were pretty smart and pretty interesting in how they would conquer people. In 2 Kings 17, verse 24, then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. These are the people that became the Samaritans that we see talked about in the New Testament. What the Assyrians did was they cleared out the Israelites and they brought in a whole bunch of transplants. And they said, here, you guys go live here. You occupy these cities. We don't want these people making their way back. And it was so at the beginning of their dwelling there that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the rituals of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and indeed they are killing them because they do not know the rituals of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, send there one of the priests whom you brought from there. Let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the rituals of the God of the land. Then one of the priests, whom they had carried away from Samaria, came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. However, every nation continued to make gods of its own and put them in the shrines on the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities where they dwelt. So you see, they were back at it, doing a little bit of both. These weren't Israelites, right? But they're now living here. They're trying to figure out, how do we appease this God? Right? This was the pagan mindset. How do we appease this God? How do we make this God happy? He's sending lions here and killing us. So clearly we need to be doing something for the God of this area and make it all work out. So they send a priest. And the priest teaches them how to fear God, how to follow God in some form. And so they do that, and they have their other gods over here on the side, and they're worshiping them all, and it's all fine. They're okay with that. We see Jesus talking to a Samaritan woman, and he says, "You worship what you don't know. The Jews worship what they know." And that was their practice. They did a lot of things that the Jews did, even in Jesus' day, but they blended it. It was all mixed up. It wasn't pure. We see many of the epistles written to combat syncretism, to combat some of the ideas that people were letting in. Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Second Corinthians 11, verse 3. "But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it." Paul's saying, I'm worried that you're going to put up with all this false teaching. That they're going to come teaching about Jesus, but it's not Jesus that they're teaching about. They're using a name, Jesus, but it's not the Jesus that he knew, that he preached. They're preaching something else. And he's telling the Corinthians, I'm worried about you because I think you're going to put up with it. I think you're going to allow it. I think you're just going to sort of let that happen and let it be there. And he didn't want them to start blending those ideas in with what he calls the simplicity that is in Christ. Again, they were tolerant of other teachings. It's sort of this God plus idea. God and something else. In 2 Peter 2, verse 1. 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. He says, "But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you." He's sort of hearkening back to ancient Israel and saying there were false prophets then. "There will be false prophets, false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them and bringing on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed." He warns them. He says, that's going to happen. And he doesn't just say, oh, that's going to happen to you because you're so terrible. He sort of sets this as a pattern and says, this happened just the same way that this happened back in ancient Israel, that there were false teachers among them. There's going to be false teachers among you. And we've seen that through the history of the church. There's always some element, right, that's always been there, some influence that's always been there. Right? This isn't a new thing. This shouldn't be a surprising thing. But there's always that element, that tendency. Satan's attacking us. He loves to attack God's church, and he hits us in various different ways. And when he can get somebody on the inside, great. That works for him. So he's warning them. He's just saying there's always going to be that element. People trying to bring in another teaching. People trying to bring in something else alongside the true worship of God, and turn true worshipers of God into people who are worshiping God and demons. Elsewhere, he talks about those who were serving idols and worshiping idols as serving demons, as worshiping demons. Right? And that's what it is. You're either worshiping God, or you're worshiping some part of Satan's collection of leadership. And it really does boil down to just that. We're either worshiping one, or we're worshiping the other. Or in some cases, we're worshiping both. And that's what we're trying, that's what he's warning them against. We see John, in 1 John, he warns them, if you go over to 1 John 4. 1 John 4 and verse 1. He says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." Again, he's not saying this to startle them. But if it shook them up and got them alert to the reality of the situation, that's good. Right? This is just how it is. There's always false teaching out there. In this country, there's plenty of false teaching out there. You can turn on the TV tomorrow morning and you'll find heaps of it. Right? There's lots of it. In the book of Revelation, we see Jesus Christ writing letters to churches, and a couple of them specifically, he says, "I've got this against you. You have the teachings of Balaam, or you have the teachings of the Nicolaitans, or you have that woman Jezebel." He said, "You have these other elements there, and you're putting up with them." He doesn't say, you know, you're all teaching this. He knows that there were some that weren't, but he's saying, you've got these elements there that are part of what you're accepting, that are part of what you're allowing. He says, you've got to get those out of there. And he warns them. And he encourages them. Syncretism today is, again, it's everywhere. Syncretism has been a long-standing practice in Christianity. Right? There are the obvious things that we can think of. Sunday worship. Worshiping God on Sunday is a practice that came from sun worship. It's a practice that came from pagan ideas. And well, it was very convenient to mix it in because, you know, if we mix this in, then all of these people that are already worshiping on Sunday, they'll be on board with what we're doing here, and we'll just change the name. Instead of Mithra or whoever they were worshiping, it'll be Jesus now. And one very, very large church, that became their practice, right? And they saw it as Jesus Christ conquering other religions is how they like to advertise it. If you've ever been to the Vatican and you go through and you look at a lot of the artwork there, you'll see a lot of the artwork has these themes of Christ conquering paganism by replacing it. One of the ones that really jumps out in my mind, there's a painting of a statue that has fallen over and it's broken and it's cracked on the floor and it's sort of laying there in the darkness and the sun is shining down on this big cross. Right? Or if you go into the Pantheon in Rome, where they used to worship all of their gods and they had them all in these little corners and you could go to whatever side and worship whichever god you want. Well, they kind of strip the name off and say, well, no, these are the apostles. Right? That's what these are. So go pray at the feet of one of the apostles. Right? We're going to replace all these pagan names with names that we're more comfortable with that are Christian. You can still do what you used to do, but, you know, point it at God and everything will be good. Right? And this is the idea of syncretism. That's been long-standing practices, right? Christmas is that way. Easter is that way. Those are practices from way, way back, ancient Babylonian times, right, that have made their way again into mainstream Christianity because it was convenient. It really helped him get a lot of followers. You got a lot of people this way when you can just sort of have them shift up who they think they're worshiping. Right? That kind of syncretism has been around for a very long time. We have more New Age syncretism as well that has been popular over the last 40, 50, 60 years. Things that have crept in. These are more recent developments, if you will, but there's this New Age movement that really, it's really hard to pin down what the New Age movement is because what their whole model is to sort of blend these ideas. Take this idea from Eastern religion and this Christian idea and merge these things. And these are really good. These are all good ideas that are going to help you to be a good, whole kind of person. That's the whole New Age model, is to bring these things together. And it is syncretism. It's just pure and simple. There are different movements, if you will, within Christianity. There are things like the health and wealth gospel. this sort of idea that, well, you know, Christianity's primary purpose really is to improve your physical life. That's what it's for. And so you'll find numerous self-help books out there that are masquerading as Christian books. Right? They have scriptures in them, and they talk about Jesus. But a lot of them are really self-help books that are promoting health and wealth. Right? And this is the old pagan idea of, well, you do these things over here for this God, and your life will be good. Go sacrifice this animal or that thing or this child to this God, and you'll have crops, and things will be great. It's the old pagan idea. That's really the health and wealth gospel. There's another one, a more recent one. It's called the Words of Faith movement. I don't know if you've heard of the Word of Faith movement. This is the teaching that Christians can gain access or can access the power of faith through speech or confession. You speak the promises that you want in faith and in agreement with the Bible, and they're given to you. So you just say the things that you want and you believe, and they'll happen, whether it's healing or a new job or whatever it is. And as long as it's in line with the Bible, right, then this is how it'll work. You got to say it, and you got to have faith and believe it. There are books out there on this. A while back, there was one called The Prayer of Jabez, very popular book. I think it was in the bestseller list for a few years even. There's a book by Joel Osteen called I Declare, 31 Promises to Speak Over Your Life. Here's the description on Amazon.com. Broken into 31 parts, this book will help readers reach the truth of God's Word and how speaking God's promises can bring about His blessings. Right? This isn't a biblical idea. This is a New Age idea. Right? You put it out there for the universe, and the universe will do whatever it does with some sort of mystic energy, and it'll come back to you. Right? This isn't a Christian idea. It's a blending of New Age ideas, of modern ideas, bringing them in and saying, this is how we should worship God. Right? Because we'll call it faith, and we'll call it confession, and we'll call it words that we see in the Bible, and we'll just sort of mix them all together. There's a very popular movement, it's been a movement for decades, called ecumenism or ecumenicalism. And really the goal of that movement is to unite Christian denominations, to say, well, all of these different warring factions, right, of Christianity, we should bring them all together. Kind of like the Cretans on that island that would all come together and fight against a common enemy. We should get all these Christian denominations together. Really, and achieve what they call communion. They want to achieve communion among believers. Everybody really needs to just come together and we all get along, and it'd be great. Often this communion, though, comes at the expense of one or both of the organizations compromising their stance on some issue. Well, they really feel this way about such and such, and they feel this way about that. So we'll both compromise the things that we hold dear, and then we can have communion, whatever that means. Right? But that whole movement promotes syncretism by encouraging groups to accept and even approve of the doctrinally erroneous ways of the other groups. Requires that you say, yeah, what they're doing is good, and we can do that too. Right? It's syncretism at its core. Why do we do this? I guess here's the real question. Why do we do this? Why do we allow these things? Why would people do this? Why could this happen in the church? Right? It does from time to time. But why? Why would we knowingly accommodate some sort of unbiblical practice and allow it? Why would we merge and blend something when we know that what we want to do is worship God purely, sincerely? We'll talk about three different causes. This is an exhaustive list. We'll talk about three different reasons here. We'll go through them fairly quickly. The first is fairly simple. It's just that we don't recognize them as false. There are some times where we will end up caught up in some sort of syncretistic way of thinking, because we don't recognize it as false. We don't know that it's wrong, right? When you think about Micah's shrine, right? He had his little shrine that his mom made for him, and he had his Levite, and he had all of his stuff sort of going on because he thought that's what was right. It was sincerely intended. He thought he would be approved because now he had a Levite for a priest. It was very sincerely intended, but he didn't understand. He didn't know that what he was doing was wrong, is what it appears. He was only partially informed or misinformed. In the case of the Samaritans, right, they wanted to be informed. How do we get this God off of our backs? And so they came and they were informed, and they were taught by a priest, but they were only partially informed. They didn't get the whole picture that, no, you have to worship God and God alone. And they sort of pursued him half-heartedly. So they didn't really know, and they didn't really care to know fully. They just wanted to get the lions to stop attacking them, really, is what it was about. Sometimes we don't recognize things as false because maybe we're not feeding on the right things. Sometimes I can let a thought get into my head and think, wow, that's a really interesting idea. And I find that I can get carried away in that thought or in that thing or whatever that thing is, right? Maybe it's because I haven't been here enough, reading this enough. What am I feeding on, right? If I am feeding on the Word of God, I'll be able to recognize truth from error. If we're Spirit-led people that are in this book, that are pursuing God, we'll be able to recognize it when we see it. We'll know. We'll be able to identify those things. But what is the source of my spiritual understanding? Where is it coming from? Is it coming from this book? Is it coming from some other book? Is it coming from some other movie, some other idea, some other person? What's the source? Where is my spiritual understanding coming from? Ideas will often be presented okay in, you know, some of these modern Christian, essentially self-help books. They're presented as okay because the intent really is to praise and glorify God. Here's what it's about. This is why we're doing it. But at the core, it's all broken. It's not actually focused on God at all. You know, we hear this with, if you've ever talked to somebody about Christmas observance or Easter observance, it's very common to be met with the reaction that, yeah, I know this comes from other things, but, you know, now we do it to praise God, right? And in that case, they can't even fall back and say, well, I didn't know. I didn't know that it wasn't true. There's just sort of a glossing over and sort of ignoring that, you know, it's okay because the intent is good. But what are we feeding on? What are we feeding on? Which book are we reading the most? Which book is the source of our spiritual understanding about God? Where does that come from? Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. Jesus quotes this in Matthew 4. It says, man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. That's where our food comes from. That's our diet. That's what helps us understand what is pure and what is not pure. That's what helps us to discern and to be able to say, no, I recognize that as some sort of blended idea that's not actually Christian. That's not actually what Jesus Christ would teach. And we can recognize it that way. James 1 and verse 21. Here's how we guard against it. James 1 and verse 21. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. So here's how we guard against this sort of failure to identify some syncretistic teaching. We have to look into this word, not just hear it, but do it. We have to be looking into it and living it. It's fairly fundamental. It's fairly basic. And we know this. These are things that we know and that I think we all try to do. But this is where we need to be pursuing. We need to be, as we've heard about this year, we need to be laboring in this word. This is where we need to be working and focusing and teaching and applying things to our life. Right? There are other books. There are a lot of things written. But this needs to be our source. This is our spiritual source. Another reason that people will accommodate syncretistic teaching is because it appeals to our human nature. Right? There's something in it that even though on the surface we might recognize that it's false, there's something about it that appeals to our human nature, and we can rationalize somehow that it's okay. This is what Israel did at Mount Sinai. Moses was gone. They didn't know what they were going to do. Let's worship God, and let's do it in the way that we know how, which is idols. And it kind of appealed to them. It made them feel safer. It made them feel maybe more at home. We don't know. There was the sensual element of rising up to play that probably appealed to them. But it appealed to some fundamental lusts. Jeroboam, when he instituted false teaching, it was for his own good. It was to ensure the security of his monarchy. He did it for his own purposes. And he introduced things. And the people accepted them for the same reasons. It appealed to their human nature. They thought, oh, good, we don't have to travel all the way down to Jerusalem. And we can all be priests now? This will be great. That's really great. I like this. And it was more accommodating. You know, you could have your household gods and worship God. This all works for me, right? And it's still good because I'm worshiping God. We'll just blend it all up and it'll be okay because it's all really at the end, it's all targeting the same God. Right? This appealed to people's human nature. This really gets down to a fundamental question of why do I serve God? Why am I here? What is the intent of my worship? Why do I do this? Why are we here today? What's our goal? What's our purpose? If we're here because we want to feel good, if we're here because we just want Christianity to make us feel like we're really good people, well, then we're going to be more susceptible to these kinds of appeals from other sources, from other ways of thinking. We're going to think, oh, yeah, I can do that because that'll make me a better person. It'll make other people feel better. It'll make other people like me or whatever it is. Right? Those things appeal to our human nature. But that's not why we're here. Let's go over to Romans 13. Romans 13 and verse 14. This is our goal, really. This is what we're trying to do. If we had to sum it up in one sentence, I think this one's a pretty good summary. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. Don't accommodate that human nature. Don't accommodate those things that are just appealing to the fleshly lusts. Putting on Jesus Christ is our goal. We're not here because being here makes us feel good. We're not here to try to make everybody else feel good. Sometimes doing what God tells us to do, it hurts. It doesn't feel good. Sometimes it doesn't always make other people feel good. But if we're putting on Jesus Christ and we're acting out of love, then it's in their best interest. And it is what's good. But really, this is why we're here. If we're not here to learn to become like God and to practice becoming like God, if we're here for some other reason, because being part of this group makes us feel good, then we're going to be susceptible to other teachings, to other ideas, to other things that may creep in. Third and last reason that I'll talk about here. Sometimes we allow and we accept syncretistic teachings because we like the people that are bringing the message. This is what Solomon did, right? He loved his wives. He had lots of wives and apparently would cater to their interests. One of them must have come to him at some point and said, hey, we're going to build this high place for this God. He must have liked the wife. Sure. Go do that. And so sometimes we do this. Sometimes we like the people that are bringing the message. And so we sort of try to find a way to accommodate that, to rationalize the message that they're bringing, to say, this is okay. But who really then are we trying to please? Who are we trying to please, first and foremost? If we're not trying to please God, first and foremost, then we're going to be susceptible to this. If we like to please other people, not that it's wrong to want to do what's good and what other people like to do, but if that's your primary goal, that's my primary goal, I'm going to be susceptible to compromising truth and to compromising what God has commanded me to do to accommodate someone else, a friend, a spouse, a family member. We can rationalize behavior because we want to make ourselves feel okay. Sometimes we compromise just to make ourselves feel better, to make our feelings good about someone. You know, we don't want to feel exclusive or elite. And so we kind of compromise and say, yeah, these people must be okay too. We can't just think that we're all that special. Right? And so, of course, we don't elevate ourselves above other people. But at the same time, we can't accommodate and say, oh, all these people are all right, just, you know, because I want to feel like all of them are okay. It's kind of silly. Sometimes we really respect how dedicated, how sincere people are. You and I both probably know quite a few people who we look at how they live their lives and we think, wow, it's really a shame that we aren't more like that, that we don't live our lives more that way, that we don't have some of those character traits, that we don't have that discipline or whatever it is. And so then we try to rationalize and say, well, you know, this person is a really good person. I really like this person. I really respect what they're doing, and what they're doing is really okay. And then we try to rationalize what they teach and what they believe as okay. Say, well, there must be something to it. This really must be okay. I know that what they're doing is what the Babylonians did 5,000 years ago. And I know that they're keeping those holidays that have been around for thousands and thousands of years. And I know that they believe in things that are totally contrary to the Bible, but I really like these people. I really want to feel okay about them. Really, it ends up being just sort of self-gratification. We don't have to feel that way about them. God has a plan for them. We sort of need to lengthen our timeline or lengthen our view. God has a plan for those people, for all of those really wonderful, really sincere, really dedicated people. He has a plan for them, and there's no reason that we can't love them. There's no reason that we can't know them and be good neighbors and have friends. Right? There's no reason that we have to sever ourselves from those kinds of people. Right? But we also don't have to rationalize and try and say, well, these must be God's people somehow, even though I know that nothing that they teach is godly. Mr. Carmelo Anastasi wrote an article about ecumenicalism in one of the most recent United News, and he made a very interesting point that this sort of thinking, it reverses the order of the two great commandments. He says it takes love toward neighbor and elevates it over love towards God. It says, yes, you want to love neighbors, and you want everybody to sort of get along and be okay with each other. But it elevates that over love of God and devotion to God and dedication to God. In his country, he lives in Italy, he sees a lot of this. There's a lot of talk about ecumenicalism and getting everybody together and making everyone okay with everybody else. But again, it's really about the people. And it sort of ignores the message. It ignores the teaching and the doctrine. Matthew 7, verse 21. Read it to you. Not everyone that says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that does the will of my Father which is in heaven. Jesus Christ didn't mix it up and say, they're really nice people. He knows the plan for them. He knows that there's a plan. He's got it worked out. He loves them. We love them. But he's not trying to make what they say or what they do or what they practice okay somehow, just because they're really nice people. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 12 and verse 29. We'll wrap up here. Deuteronomy 12 and verse 29. This command is just as true for us today as it was for them. When the Lord God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land. And if you look at our history, that's very similar to our history. We're here as a people, as a nation, because we've dispossessed people and we live here now. And God has blessed us. Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor take away from it. We're not to seek after the ways of the religions around us. We're not to look at them and try to figure out, what do they do? How do they observe their holy days? What kind of gospel do they preach? And maybe we should be preaching that. We don't need to feed off of their books, their ideas, their teachings, their sermons. Those don't need to be the source of our spiritual understanding. We know where our source needs to be. We know where it comes from. We know we don't want to add to it. We don't want to take away from it. We try to be very careful in how we observe and how we handle God's word. So as we labor in it, as we work in it, let's be very careful not to be blending in, not to be merging ideas, not to be seeking after other ways of doing things, but to be doing them in a pure and in a whole way. And not too long, we're going to be celebrating a time when it says that the knowledge of God will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. We read in Isaiah 2 about people coming from all nations to learn about God, to learn about his ways. Not to learn how to mix anything, but they're wanting to go and learn about this pure, good way. What is that? How can we do that? And just that, and let's do it the way that God wants us to do it. We ought to be pursuing God that way now, even. That should be our intent. To think of being able to go up to the mountain of the Lord and learn his ways and walk in his paths. We ought to be pursuing that. 1 John 3:3, we'll close there. We have that hope. We have a hope of being a part of that kingdom, of being able to help those people at that time to learn this pure and good way. A time when this way will be practiced both in spirit and in truth. Not compromising one or the other. Nothing will be blended. Nothing will be added to. It will be pure. John tells us this as he was writing to a church late in the first century, he's struggling to get them to have this same focus, as they were bombarded by all the different ideas of their day and the different Christian movements that were coming up and creeping their way into the church. He encourages them with this. He says, and everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. We have that hope in us. Let's purify ourselves and purify the way that we seek our God.